All right, this is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference for the 25th of January, 2017. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis are the facilitators, and Craig McKee is our trustee secretary. Craig, you want to call the roll?
Okay, what I have so far, I have, in addition to Graham McQueen, I have Barbara Honegger, Bill Wilt, Charles Ewing Smith, Cheryl Curtis, Ken Freeland, myself, David Cole, James Hufford, John O'Malley, and Michael Cook. Did I get everybody?
Did you get Cheryl?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I think
okay.
So, yeah.
Unfortunately, fairly low attendance tonight. I don't know what that is, but again, the fact that we had a teleconference last week may explain that to some degree. But again, we're recording it for the benefit of those who couldn't make it tonight, so hopefully a lot of other people will hear this later. Okay, our first item on our agenda, as always, is to approve the minutes as circulated by Craig. Any objections to approving the minutes from the previous teleconference as copied in the draft agenda? Hearing none.
Did you get the Boston 9/11 group members in there, about 10 people?
I didn't get any list of people, so I don't think I do have that. But if somebody can give me the names, like in an email, I can put them in before the I can put them into the final version of the minutes. This is just the draft.
Okay, what's your email?
It's Craig McKee, CraigMckee, 911 at gmail.com.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, yeah, so if you send that along, I'll make sure that gets in there for sure.
The minutes will be amended to include the names of our Boston callers from the previous teleconference. Any other amendments to the minutes? Okay, hearing none, the minutes are otherwise approved, and we'll look at the draft agenda for tonight, which is fairly limited. We have two guests to speak, and the first one is present. So if there's no objection, we'll go ahead and proceed with the draft agenda and adopt it for tonight's program. Any objection? Hearing none, then our first guest is the illustrious Graham McQueen, and to introduce him, Cheryl Curtis. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, thanks. Graham McQueen was a founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He's co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a Ph.D. in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He also was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. He's the author of the book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, and is a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. His extensive research and presentations on 9/11 has been a huge asset to the 9/11 Truth Movement. And Graham, welcome.
Thank you, Cheryl. Shall I start?
Yes.
Okay, there is one little correction there, and otherwise that was beautiful. Thanks very much. I recently stepped down from the position of co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies after 4 or 5 years, so I'm not currently in that position anymore, but I did it for a while. Okay, so...
Could I ask who took your position, Graham? It's Barb.
I actually don't know. I hope Kevin has found somebody by now, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
So this will be a bit informal, and maybe Ken or Cheryl can cut me off if I start to go more than 15 minutes. I'll try not to. So I was asked to come on here because of an article that I had published on Global Research the other day on a recent poll about the views of British Muslims. So I'm not going to try and repeat everything I said in that article. You can pull it up rather quickly and read it. But I just want to put it in context a little bit and then say a few words about some of the things that I think are most important that I discovered. So I was in the process of doing research for a completely different article, an article that was discussing the left, especially in North America, and its strange attitude toward 9/11 truth. And I should say I am a member of the left, so it's not, I'm not attacking the left from some other ideological position. It's more like self-criticism. Anyway, I was in the process of that, and I decided it was important to get up to date on polls that have been conducted on the 9/11 issue. And I'm sure a lot of you have little folders in your hard drive somewhere like I do on polls on 9/11. There's all kinds of them. They're often very messy. They're very frustrating because they seldom ask the same questions, and therefore it's very hard to compare one with another. It's very hard to tell what the trends are. Anyway, I was in the middle of that frustrating kind of search when I discovered by accident that a very recent poll had just been carried out and published. I was doing this research just this past December, and I found out that in early December, I don't remember now, something like December 5th, the results of a recent poll had been carried out, quite a large poll, in the United Kingdom. And it was to look at the views of Muslims on a whole variety of subjects. And I thought, okay, well, that's interesting, because apparently 9/11 was one of those subjects. So that's how this started off. In other words, kind of an accident that I got into this. And I was intrigued by what I discovered and thought, well, I'll just write a short little article on this, see if Global Research will publish it, and then go back to my original project, which is more or less what's happened. Now, I should say that I discovered that there's a think tank in the UK that sponsored this poll. I hadn't heard of it before. It's called Policy Exchange. It turns out it's a right-wing think tank in the UK that has a very close relationship with the Conservative Party in that country, and that the chair of the Board of Trustees is David Frum. Many of you will know who he is, a well-known neocon, friend of Richard Perle, so-called creator of the term Axis of Evil, for you know, supposed to designate U.S. enemies that need to be picked off one at a time. He wrote a book with Richard Perle defending the invasion of Iraq in 2003, advocating regime change in Iran and Syria and blah, 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 on and on, a great believer in the war on terror. So I thought, what the hell is a group like this doing carrying out a poll of British Muslim views? And I'm sure you know the answer to that. It's an antagonistic poll, and it raises a lot of questions about the uses to which public polls can be put. In this case, I think it's to put further pressure on British Muslims to provide a lot of information about them on a lot of topics, which could be, I'm sure it's already being entered into MI5's database. For all I know, they came up with half the questions. I don't know. In any case, the point of it seems to be to put them under magnifying glass, but also to put pressure on them and make them feel, I don't know what the term is really, policed, if you like. And if you ask the question, well, yeah, but what did the poll results actually show? That's it's interesting what they showed. If I picture David Frum talking to an MI5 guy, who probably be a guy in some men's club in London, I would picture Frum saying, well, there's bad news and good news. The bad news is they don't actually come off as very dangerous. I mean, a lot of them are socially conservative. They like law and order. My God, they even like police. They seem loyal to the UK. And the worst part of all, of course, which we already knew from other polls, is that they dislike terrorism and political violence even more than our control group. So that's really bad news. But the good news is that there is one thing we can use against them, and that is they really disbelieve the story of 9/11. I mean, nobody frickin' believes it. I mean, this is extreme. We have merely 4% of that population that thinks Al-Qaeda or Muslim terrorists carried out 9/11. 4%. It's almost negligible. So because the belief that Muslim terrorists were behind 9/11 is crucial to the official story, we can conclude from this that a maximum of 4% of these people believe the official story of 9/11. And in contrast to that 4%, 31% of them think the U.S. was behind it. That's eight times as many think the U.S. was behind it. Now, of course, the question arises as to how we can use that. There's nothing violent about it. There's nothing particularly dangerous about it. But here's my idea. First of all, we say this 9/11, and here you get the point, I'm pretending I'm David Frum here, right, talking to MI5. So we say that this 9/11 descent is a conspiracy theory. This is a very useful term, as you know. We're careful not to define it, because the minute we define it, the whole thing falls apart. We say that it is, of course, a product of delusion, and we say that it feeds into the other delusion that Muslims have in the UK, and that is that the Muslim world is under some kind of attack from the West. Imagine such a stupid idea. And this delusion, these delusions feed the feeling of British Muslims that they're victims and that they need somehow to respond to Western aggression. And that, of course, in turn feeds extremism and terrorism. So if you actually work it out carefully, you can make it look like 9/11 descent promotes extremism and terrorism. I know it's a bit tortuous, but we can make it work, especially if we throw in the anti-Semitism card. So to conclude, we will tell the UK government that they're on the right track with their current plan, which is to make what they call nonviolent extremism illegal, because that is the current plan. And we'll help them with this plan by folding conspiracy theories in. In other words, conspiracy theories will become a crucial part of nonviolent extremism. And if we play our cards right, we may be able to make 9/11 truth illegal, or at the very least, get people fired from their jobs and made social scum if they hold these views. I mean, you can think of other examples of being a member of the Communist Party in the McCarthy period, or perhaps being a Holocaust denier, or just a few examples of things that have been so badly, stigmatized, you know, and even you throw people in jail for it. So that's the direction we're headed, and although it may seem like pretty thin gruel, we think that we're happy with the results of our poll. So, okay, I stopped being David Frum here, just so that you're not confused. And I will try and sum up. First of all, I was kind of shocked when I first saw the speech that then Prime Minister David Cameron gave to the UN General Assembly a couple of years ago, in which he denounced conspiracy theories, gave 9/11 as an example, implied it was anti-Semitic, and went on to say quite specifically that his government was going to take an initiative against extremism, including nonviolent extremism. This is his term, by the way. I didn't make that up. And I have found out since then that the initiative to make extremism illegal in the UK continues. It's run into lots of controversy, but the initiative continues. And extremism, it took me a while to find a definition of it, because British Muslims were asked, you know, the term extremism, just like the term conspiracy theory, was used in this poll, but neither was defined. So God knows, when you're answering a question in a poll, you don't know what they mean. Anyway, eventually I found a British government definition of extremism. I don't have it here in the exact words, but it's something like public rejection of fundamental British values. And that can mean God knows what, right? I mean, that's very dicey stuff. So what we've got here is an initiative to make extremism, this very foggy thing, illegal in the UK, and to fold the 9/11 so-called conspiracy theory into that, to make it part of extremism. And I think that we in the 9/11 truth movement need to be aware of this initiative. So that's really the main point I want to make here tonight, but I'll make two other points as I sum up. One is, I don't think they're anywhere close to actually pulling this off, at least on a world scale. According to the polls I've looked at, the number of people in the world who are willing to support the official narrative of 9/11 is about 2.9 billion, and the number who aren't willing to support it is about 4.6 billion. In other words, it's a minority view. However, I don't think this is a basis for complacency, because the places where they would be trying to make it illegal are probably the UK, the US, Canada, and some of the European countries, and it's possible they might pull it off. Finally, I think at some point we need to think, we, 9/11 Truth Movement, think a little more deeply about our relationship with the Muslim world, because they are, as far as I can tell from the polls, far and away the greatest skeptics about 9/11. It's true that the British poll was more extreme than usual, but typically in most of these polls, in British Muslim populations around the world, there's no more than about between 17 and 21% that accepts the official story. So they really are skeptics. And figuring out what that means and how we can support this quite impressive resistance. I mean, think about British Muslims. They are in one of the most propaganda major media. All the major political parties, politicians, spokespeople, intellectuals are constantly reiterating the official narrative, just as they are in Canada and the United States, and yet virtually no British Muslim buys it. That is a really interesting thing to think about. And I'm not saying that what we need to do is kind of cuddle up to them and say, gee, let's be friends, because we could actually be a live threat. But at the same time, we need to respect what they're doing and see if we can find ways to provide them with the highest quality information that that we can. So I think I'm going to stop there.
Well, Grant, that certainly was concise. Thank you for that. Before we get to the question period, we need to take care of some housekeeping issues here. We have our caller with a 519 number. Who is that, please?
Anita,
that's
I just
me.
Joined.
Yeah, that's
hi,
Anita.
Anita.
Yudney. Hello?
Hello, Anita just joined.
Well, wait a minute. I think we already have. I already have you. I'm talking about the person with the 519 area code.
Yeah, that's me, Key Dudney.
That's Key. Thank you, Key. Oh, great. Well, that takes care of a lot of our problems. Okay, good.
Yeah. Well, so, I couldn't get in on my landline, but I got into my cell phone line. Go figure.
Good enough. Thanks for joining. Okay, we're going to be with
hey,
you shortly.
Hey, you're the cell phone expert too, Key.
Excuse me. Okay, so We have also on the line now Wayne Kosky, Anita Renfrew, and Key Dudney, our next guest, has joined us. So now we will go into our Q&A mode. One moment, please.
Yep.
And in Q&A mode, if you would like to make a comment or ask a question of our first guest, you may do so by pressing *6, and you will automatically be listed in the queue to ask a question or make a comment. *6 if you wish to make a comment or ask a question. Okay, and I see Barbara is ready to ask a question. Go ahead, Barbara.
Am I on? It's Barb.
Yep.
I can hear
okay.
you, Barb.
Can everybody hear me? Okay. Well, I just wanted to make a comment. Great presentation. Thank goodness you did this, Graham. Thank you. It sounds to me like the good news in this poll that would really counter their ability to try to pull off this scam of trying to make it illegal to, be telling the truth about 9/11 is the fact that in those poll results, all of those Muslims who only 96% don't believe the official story. They're also against terrorism. They're for the police. It just doesn't jive to try to lead people to believe that they're extremists under those conditions, correct?
I absolutely agree, Barb, and tried to make the point in the article, but they do have this devious argument that they're trying to make. And we have to remember that most of the public will not read this lengthy poll. They will go by the summaries and propaganda that they find in the media, and that's why we need to be ready with our arguments.
Right. Now, I don't know if you heard this, Graham, but it's relevant to this, and I think you might have been off the call when I mentioned it earlier.
I was.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure that you and everyone know that the complete hornet's nest that's on the front pages of all of the nation's newspapers, MSNBC, CNN, everywhere, that President Trump has just claimed, and they're calling it a lie, which it is, that he has just claimed that he didn't win the popular vote against Hillary Clinton because 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants voted. Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, was asked in a very
hostile
conference.
Yeah, Barbara,
I'm almost done.
It's just not on the subject here.
John Spicer was asked what the source was, and the source was Alex Jones, and now the President of the United States is being called the Commander-in-Chief of Conspiracy Theory on mainstream media right now.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Next is Bill Welt.
Hi, this is Bill. So I just looked up David Frum, and he's born in Toronto, citizen of Canada. He was George W. Bush's speechwriter.
Yep.
Which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yep.
The other thing I want to point out is along with the devious stuff that Graham has pointed out, or this interesting survey, there is a website, canarymission.org, canary in the mine shaft, that's being run to put names of students in North America, the two continents, Canada, United States, who support BDS on a blacklist. And it looks like they've done, Tony Hall is a professor on the list. They have individuals, professors, students. The easiest way to qualify is to stand for BDS, but they're going after people who, quote, foment hatred of the United States, the State of Israel, and I guess Jewishness or Zionism. And they also saw an Al Jazeera, like 3 or 4 part, investigative report on how the personnel at the Israeli embassy in Britain is running this very extensive operation to infiltrate all of the young, like the Young Labor Party and all that sort of thing, to infiltrate them and co-opt them into, trips to Israel and help financially, and just really dirty stuff.
Yep.
So I thought, that's why I'm sort of focusing on the myth of 6 million. I think we ought to go back to first causes, and get the myth of 6 million cleared up. Even though it does go back to, actually the first use is about 1850, 1860, but since World War II. And it's something that's iterated over and over and over. As one of the authors I read said, there's not a day that goes by that some activity to remember the Holocaust has not taken place. And it turns out that if you tell the story long enough, it really does become true. No, that's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Can I respond briefly?
Yes, please, go ahead.
I won't get into it in detail here, but it is an important and very difficult, very touchy, complicated issue for the 9/11 truth movement.
Oh, yeah.
On the one hand, Obviously, the Holocaust and anti-Semitism and so on are expressions that have been largely successful to make certain views completely taboo. And if 9/11 truth movement is associated with it, it risks self-destruction. At the same time, I'm not advocating running scared. I mean, we're people who are interested in the truth about things. We're all going to read and investigate on our own. And certainly, I believe that in some fashion, Israel was involved in the operation we're talking about. So we need to work that through. It's always a little bit weird, I must say, in a teleconference situation like this, discussing this, because I assume this conversation is all being monitored and fed into various databases.
Well, it's recorded anyway.
Yeah, I don't just mean by you, though. Yeah. I mean by other people.
No,
But anyway, let me just say, maybe it's not a time to get into it in detail now, but it has to be on our agenda at some point.
Okay, thanks, Green. Okay, I don't see any other people ready to ask questions, but let me take it off of this Q&A mode. Okay, I think everybody's muted now, but if you press *6, you'll be unmuted. And if you didn't get a chance to ask a question because of technical problems, this is your opportunity to just press *6 and say you have a question, okay?
I have one, Ken. This is Craig.
Yeah.
I'm unmuted, but I... Yeah, hi, Graham.
Hi, Craig.
One thing you mentioned, maybe I didn't catch enough of this one remark to fully get what you were saying. You made a reference at some point to there being 4.6 billion being against the official story and 2.something billion supporting it. And I think I sort of lost the thread of that as to what you were saying there and what those numbers were referring to.
Yeah, I did go through that rather quickly, so I'm sorry. If you look in the article, you'll find that I paid a fair bit of attention to the poll carried out in 2008 by, I think it's called worldpublicopinion.org, because it was a large one. It involved, I don't remember now, something like 16,000 people being interviewed in 17 countries. And I am interested in international polls. We get constantly told, well, this is what Americans think and this is what British think. But I want to know about the world, including very big countries like China and India and so on. So anyway, if you look at that poll and if you do a few mathematical calculations, which I don't want to get into here, although if you want me to, I will, what I concluded was that about 39% of the people in those countries, and I think it's, from what I've seen, that's representative. So I think that's probably a good poll to give us a view of the world as a whole. 39% of the total number of people represented in that poll are willing to say that Al-Qaeda was behind 9/11. And all the rest are not willing to say that. That doesn't mean they oppose it, but they're not willing to say, yeah, I'm going to tick that box. A lot of them say they don't know who did it, which is perfectly respectable. And others think that, for example, the U.S. may have done it. And so I decided that I would see what that actually looked like when you began applying those percentages to the current world population, assuming that those figures are still roughly true today. Well, today we have about 7.5 billion people in the world. And if 39% of them affirm the official story, then it comes to about 2.9 billion. And if the rest don't affirm the official story, that's about 4.6 billion.
Ah.
Now, I'll just add one more thing, and then I'll shut up. If we ask the more specific question, what percentage of the world's population thinks the U.S. was behind it, that's a smaller number, but it's not trivial. I think it's about, I would guess it's about 14% of the world population thinks the U.S. was behind it. And that comes to a billion people in today's figures. Even if we exclude all the people under 18, so-called children, we still come to 700 million. And to me, that's a significant figure. So if somebody says this is a fringe phenomenon, do you belong to that small band of kooks? You can say, well, the small band I belong to is 700 million adults.
Wow. And so it also means that 4.6 billion are at least not convinced that the official story is true.
Yeah, I call them non-believers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that should pretty well end this segment of our teleconference. I want to thank Graham McQueen very much for his effort to be with us tonight. It was a considerable effort, but we did manage to figure out how to solve a technical problem. Graham, you're always welcome back. Anytime you have anything to discuss, just let us know, and we'll always be sure to schedule you in, okay?
Thank you very much, Ken, and thank you, everybody. And I'm going to have to go now, partly because I'm costing you money with this link. But I will hopefully listen to the rest of the discussion with Key. Hi, Key. I'm going to listen to that, hopefully, if it's recorded. So bye, everybody.
It will, and I'll send you the link so you can listen to it online. Okay.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Yep. Bye.
Okay, so now we move on to our second segment, and we have another very important academic with us tonight. That would be A.K. Kidudny, and here to introduce him is our own Ph.D., James Hopper. Go ahead, James. James? Oh, you're muted. Hang on. Why are you muted? Let's unmute you. Go ahead, James. Oh, you're still muted.
Now?
Okay, we can hear you now.
Okay, I unmuted before, but it didn't take, I guess. Anyway, this will be kind of off the top of my head, but I consider Key a friend. I think that's an appropriate designation. And he's a, as I understand, a professor emeritus at University of Waterloo in Ontario, of mathematics, I believe, and he's a real Renaissance man. He's a he's a novelist and author. He's a scientist. He's a mathematician, of course. He's well known to 9/11 truthers for being the perpetrator of the study of the use of cell phones at altitude circa 2001, and finding out, of course, that 2001 model cell phones at least don't work at any sort of altitude, and kind of shooting that aspect of the official story down. And tonight he's going to be talking about a subject that's a little far afield from all of those interests, but still extremely intriguing and more than a little scary. And that is the, as I understand it, the likely effects on the human population of extended blackout from a pulse or a terrorism or whatever puts the grid down. So, Key, did I get all that right?
Pretty much, except that I'm a professor emeritus of computer science at the University of Western Ontario, but my degrees are from the University of Waterloo. So I would say you were at least half right.
At least half right. Well, that's pretty good for me.
Hey, that's better than you usually do, James.
Yes, that's true. I'll take it.
Okay. One moment before we get started, Key, let me put us in and unmute you so that we won't have any background disturbance here. And you should be ready to go. Keith, please.
Okay. You want me to start?
Yes, please.
Okay. My presentation is rather preliminary in the sense that I haven't been at this very long. I was very curious to see how bad things would get if there were an extended power failure over a wide area. Now, I can't say that I've gone much beyond a rather preliminary, rather sketchy overview of a number of power failures that have occurred historically, and I decided to use flooding events as a kind of parallel civic disaster in which I can at least get some idea of what I call the mortality curve. Now, my latest reincarnation since about the year 1995 is as a population biologist. I've got a book coming out in April on theoretical population biology, and I'm interested in the subject. It's largely statistical, but it does give you an idea of what you have to do to assess population changes and any count of any population undergoing any kind of change would come under this kind of umbrella. Having said that, I want to point out that there are a couple of interesting scientific issues that you run across when you try to do this sort of thing, and that is understanding, for example, in 2003, there was a two-day power failure in New York State and northeastern Canada, not all of it by any means, but a good chunk of it, in which or during which 90 people died. Now, this figure of 90 people is actually fairly solid. It's the only study that has ever been published, to my knowledge, of the mortality resulting from an electricity blackout. The story was written, or at least the article was published by G. Burke Anderson and Michelle L. Bell, of John Hopkins School of Public Health in Baltimore, and it was published, I believe, in a book in a journal called Epidemiology. Yes, it's called Epidemiology. And that's a reasonable journal to publish in for this sort of article. Now, what they give methods, results, discussion, background. It's a well-organized paper, and they account for all kinds of collateral effects and possible other sources of mortality, and they factor out various, getting rid of the people who would have died anyway was sort of one of their achievements, and finding a residuum of some 90 people whose deaths is attributable directly or indirectly to the power failures. If it hadn't happened, in other words, these people would still have been alive at the end of that period. So that's your basically your rough criterion for assessing the mortality. Now, what I'm really interested in here, from a theoretical point of view, if you like, is what I call the mortality curve. This is the tendency for the number of deaths to climb faster than linearly. Let's say you get 90 deaths in 2 days. Does that mean 160 deaths in 4 days, or 320 in 6 days, or whatever? In other words, does it go up linearly? I don't think so. It has to go up faster than that. It's more like exponential. So I switched, having located at least a few lists of the worst power failures known so far, both in North America and around the world. I then turned to floods to look at the mortality from floods and to make a rough estimate anyway of the growth rate of deaths as a function of time in a flood. I arrived by sort of by hook and by crook at a very preliminary figure of about 100 deaths in 1 week after a reasonably deep and long-lasting, deep and widespread flood. That's something else we have to deal with here when we're dealing with this sort of question, because there's a question not only of duration but also extent of the power failure or extent of the flood. Duration of the power failure or duration of the flood. Where the flood happened or where the power failure happened also makes a difference. Some places have better services and better emergency response teams in place than others. So all of that sooner or later has to be taken into account. But my rough figures at this point point to maybe about, for your average, you know, 1 week flood, we could expect 100 people to die, presumably most of them from drowning. By the way, during a flooding event, a severe one anyway, the power is usually out because they don't want to run power into a flooded area. That's quite dangerous. So people in the flooded areas tend to be without power. So I expect the mortality figures for floods is going to be a little higher than it would be for a power failure alone. That seems a reasonable assumption going in. So if you have 100 deaths in 1 week, what kind of mortality curve would you have to get the roughly 2 million to 3 million deaths estimated to arrive, to result from the great 1931 flood in central China, which took in some four or five provinces in total when several rivers, not just the Yalu or the Yangtze, overran their banks and flooded huge low-lying areas full of people who were busy harvesting crops. See, cropland tends to be rather low-lying. Anyway, up to 4 million people are estimated to have lost their lives during that flooding event. So I took that as my sort of upper limit in terms of duration. That was some 4 months. It lasted from July through October. So if you take, you know, you want to get mortality as a function of duration, the only exponential or sub-exponential curve that would give you that kind of result is something a little under 2 times per week. In other words, you almost double the 1 week mortality to get the 2 week mortality. And then in the next week, you double the mortality of the first 2 weeks to get the mortality of the third week. In other words, you almost double what you have already when you get to the end of the next week, just using weeks as my steps. Now, going by steps like that is also an approximation, but we're in a very approximate world at this particular state of the inquiry, so that sort of thing is allowable. So it looks like just under a 2 times, doubling, almost a doubling every week, the death toll doubles. And I expect that it may not double during a power failure of equal duration, but I would certainly expect it to be maybe more like 1.5, but that still gives you a pretty big number after this is, now we're starting with 90 every 2 days, if you want to use the New York power failure as a basis, and that will give you maybe a figure that's comparable. You might figure out 1 million or more people dying after 1 month, even, from an extensive power failure. And we mustn't forget also that if it's extended over a large area as well as a long period of time, you have a complete breakdown of services. And just stop and think for a moment about everything you have, everything you do that depends in one way or another on electrons. The electrons that go through your computer, the ones that run your phone, the ones that run your microwave, your stove, the ones that power all the buildings in your city or your locale. And you have to think about what happens to the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people living in high-rise apartments with no power. Many of them are elderly. They just wanted a nice view to go with their retirement. Now they're faced with 20 flights of stairs just to go down and get some milk from a 7-Eleven, which isn't even open. You've got police cars that are all running on emergency power. Gasoline supplies have to be rationed. Some people have emergency generators, but most don't. Most facilities don't have emergency generators. The city hall has an emergency generator, usually, and so do police and hospitals. But they have to be, you know, if you've got an extended power failure, you have to keep going and gassing them up. And there's all kinds of people. The first week or so is going to see a lot of gangs roaming around looking for houses that are empty, and they'll go in and raid them for food. But after about 1 week, the gangs will all disappear because their cars will be out of gas because they're too stupid to store it up beforehand. Well, should I say they weren't informed? Anyway, that will be a problem for the first week or so, and then I don't think there'll be any problem with roving gangs except for the ones on foot. Law and order will be largely broken down. It's sort of going to be every man for himself. People will go to neighbors, have you got any food, have you got any food. If I was wise enough to store a package of emergency rations in my basement, it'll be gone in a day or two if I'm too kind-hearted. And, you know, there's a good moral question there. Am I going to keep it for myself and my wife, or am I going to share it with others and lose it very quickly? These are all very tricky, difficult questions to deal with, and extended power failures will do that to you. Now, I haven't got a whole lot more than this. I can tell you when the most horrible power failures occurred, but I've got a document here off the internet, for example, called the 12 biggest electrical blackouts in history, and most of these are, let's see, Northeast United States and Northern Canada, 1965. Thailand, nationwide blackout, 1978. Canada's geomagnetic storm, 1989. That was an interesting one because it was caused by a CME, or coronal mass ejection. Occasionally, the sun gives a great electromagnetic burp, and out comes this huge plume of extremely hot and energetic gas, which, if it happens to be aimed at the Earth, will generally take out your whole grid that happens to be on the exposed side of the Earth. And that happened to Canada in 1989, and also it affected as far south as Texas. And even Cuba, you could see the northern lights that resulted from that burst. Southern Brazil in 1999, India 2001. These are all the worst ones, right? Northeast United States and Canada, 2003, that's the one that had that study done, and that's makes a good baseline. Italy, 2003. Java and Bali, Indonesia, 2005. Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, 2006. That was a big one. That was from a German power company that switched off a high-voltage line. These things are always triggered, except for the CME, are triggered by some substation shutting down owing to a technical difficulty, or maybe there's a storm and a tree falls on a line and the line cuts off, so the station goes offline. So other stations that may be overtaxed, supplying people with air conditioning or whatever, they go down, and then it's sort of like a multiple row of dominoes, you know, spreading through the whole network, and before you know it, you've got thousands and thousands of square miles that are without power. Zhengzhou, China, 2008, Brazil and Paraguay in 2009, and India, number 12, in 2012. And these all have small accounts accompanying them, which give you some insight into how bad it was. But they all, let's see, did they give a death? No, the death tolls are for the floods. So anyway, that's about all I have at the moment. It's an interesting subject, and I think it's one that, for example, our own university is supposed to have a program in environmental science and sustainability. That's what it's called. Well, if you're going to study sustainability, it's going to be more than just a buzzword for you. You should be doing things like this. You should be publishing extensive studies of things that society has to be careful for. That's the function of a university, is to be a warner, to be a source of information about not just the science and art that it produces, but the emergencies that it would have help us to be prepared for. So sustainability, I mean, if you've got a large loss of life, that certainly is a sustainability issue, if anything is. So I'm going to be writing soon to the head of our program to see whether they can maybe apply for some funding to get that kind of study going, and because I think it is important. Anyway, I think that's about all I have to say, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you want to start it maybe a little earlier than you would have otherwise.
Yeah. Okay, Keith, thank you. That was at least as interesting as I'd hoped that it would be. Let's hope it doesn't become relevant anytime soon. Before we get to the questions, I wanted to talk to you about the problems you had calling in. What exactly happened when you were trying to call in?
You mean when I dialed into the teleconference number?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the exact quote is in my email to James Hufford, and I believe it went something like, "We're sorry, the number you called cannot be reached from this line or this number."
Mm-hmm.
Just can't.
And you were calling from the landline, right?
I was calling from my landline, so it took me about 5 minutes to get the bright idea of trying my cell phone, which actually worked.
Okay, I'm going to email you later tonight and ask you to send me your landline number from which you called, okay, so that I can share
this
that with the telecom. No, this is Ken.
Is that James
this
I'm talking to?
No, this is Ken Freeland you're talking to, the facilitator of the telecom.
Oh, Ken, okay.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, Ken.
Nice to meet you,
too. Yeah, I sent James that. I sent James that number. I could give you the number right now
if
you don't mind.
No, send it to James. James can send it to me. That's fine. You don't have to trouble yourself.
Okay.
So
anyway, it's a 519 number.
Yeah.
It's a 519 number. My cell phone is not. Is what?
You're also calling from 519 number now, right?
No. I'm calling from my cell phone. Oh, maybe it is.
It is a 519 number. Yes, it is.
Is it?
Yep.
Okay, all right. So it's the 519 number, too, but it's a different number.
Okay. Well, as long as you send James the original, I'll share that with the teleconference people and see and find out about why you weren't able to connect. But thank you for that information. Okay, we're going to go into question and answer mode here. So one moment, please.
How many people we got listening, Ken?
We've got about... say 10 people, probably more because the Boston. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Roughly 10 to 12 people right now on the line, but others will listen in later, and will be able to hear it because it's recorded, and then we post the link to the recording. So, in addition to this dozen of people, okay.
Okay.
Who would like to ask a question? *6 if you would like to be on the queue to ask a question. Looks like James is first. Go ahead, James. James Hufford.
Yeah. Yes. First of all, Keith's number that he gave me is probably...
No, don't read it out. Don't read it out on the air, please. Just send it to me by email. We don't want to publish it.
We don't want any people calling Keith.
No, we don't want to call in that direction. Thank you.
Okay, anyway, I have do have a question. According to the novelist Scott B. Williams, two of whose works I've read... on the after effects of a solar pulse, he says that the pulse will knock out any automobiles or any internal combustion engines or any equipment with any kind of computerized mechanism. Which would be anything in the past 10 or 15 years. Key, do you know anything about that? Does that ring true with you?
it all depends on the strength and severity of the CME. I guess we're going to call them CMEs, okay, and stick to the lingo. Mm-hmm. Coronal mass ejection is what it means. Yeah. And if it's powerful enough, now there apparently was one in 1917, if I have that right, shortly after the first few telegraph lines had been set up across the continent, both in Canada and the U.S. And when that thing hit the earth, telegraph operators, and of course every train station had one, and a lot of municipal offices had one, every telegraph operator got huge shocks off of his equipment, and lines went down, and the whole telegraph system became inoperable. Now, that's not microelectronics. That's just plain electric utility infrastructure.
Sure.
When you're talking about computers, of course, if you're talking about really tiny circuits, then you're talking about very high frequencies. So any of the high-frequency radiation that arrives with that coronal mass ejection is going to affect, the smaller electronic configurations like you find in control devices and cell phones and, any micro mini computer, any computer really will get knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's part of the a big part of electronic warfare too, is to be able to create EMPs or electromagnetic pulses, as they call them, which will knock out a whole battleship or aircraft or land vehicle with a more precise aim and a pulse of the right frequency and strength and duration. So that's certainly a believable scenario, but it's not clear that any but the most powerful CMEs would cause that kind of effect. I mean, we do get minor ones. Every time a sunspot is aimed right at the Earth, we're getting a certain amount of additional radiation, but nothing like a CME would cause, apparently.
Yeah.
Anyway, I keep an eye on sunspots too. So,
sure.
That's about all I could tell you, James.
Well, according to Scott Williams, with motorized traffic down, that means there's no deliveries to grocery stores and no getting, escaping cities for less populated areas that would be less subject to crime and attack and violence and so forth.
That's right.
And would intensify the effects.
Oh, yeah. No, the breakdown of society, the infrastructure, the support services, the utilities will all be gone, basically. The police have no idea what to do. They'll call in the Canadian Army or the National Guard or whatever happens to be the local force to add additional... but they themselves are going to be in trouble. They will have nothing to eat. You're right. That's it's going to be a problem of unforeseen magnitude, and this is why let's get a handle on this now. And your author friends may actually be leading the way in this endeavor.
The Army won't even be able to move themselves to supply anybody or to help with the emergency.
That's right. I mean, if I'm climbing the stairs and I have a heart attack, well, good luck.
Because
I'm alone. Now, I should mention another book to go with your authors, and that's Ted Koppel, whom I believe is the same one who used to be the host of Nightline.
Yeah.
Do you remember Ted Koppel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, he's written a book called Lights Out, and apparently it's all about the effect of power failures. I ordered it from Amazon, and it should be in my mailbox tomorrow, so I'll go looking for it.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
I also...
thank you, Jim. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go on to Michael Cook. Michael Cook is next.
Hey there. Am I heard?
Yes.
Hey, great. Yeah, this is Mike Cook. Thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate all your contributions, and this is an interesting and unexpected turn of conversation here. I'm kind of happy to hear it. I don't want to be a fear monger, You know, I don't want to be like, you know, any of that stuff. But it's our modern civilization is very precariously poised for collapse, slow degeneration in all kinds of ways. I've been an environmentalist for a long time. I've studied up on climate change, global warming for 25 years, and things are really grim. And one way or another, unless, maybe even if we make every effort we can possibly make, which, you know, is absolutely not happening to any degree at all, but even if we did do everything humanly possible to avert disaster, it's very likely that disasters are coming. And I just encourage everybody to, you know, kind of be ready. You don't have to get insane about it, but it is, you know, a reality to deal with. And anybody that's ever been in any kind of natural disaster, you know, you have an idea. And if you haven't been in anything that is like a real serious situation, then you really don't have an idea.
Yeah.
But, it's kind of one of those things that you have to go through. If people are, you know, getting real seriously hurt and dying around you, you know, stuff's going haywire, you really do need to be able to, you know, take care of yourself. And, boy, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You know, it's good to have some stuff together. I've got, like, you know, maybe 3 months' worth of food. I try to keep up on water. It's a lot more difficult. It's heavy and everything like that. I get it from a spring way out in the mountains. But
are you in a rural house or an urban one?
No, I was sort of blessed, born and now living again in northern Kentucky, right across the river from Cincinnati. So I'm in a very urban area right here. I've got a big enough yard that if things didn't get too crazy, I could be having a nice big garden, and I've got enough other people around who are together with their stuff to, you know, kind of keep going here. But if the shit really hit the fan, I'd just drop everything and run for the deep woods. And way out in the hills in Kentucky, you can be very isolated. There's hardly anybody out there. The people that are out there are hillbillies, and they've been living off the land their whole life. You know,
I think people like that are going to be the ultimate survivors of any prolonged, you know, national disaster on this scale. I might point out, too, that the vast majority of people, especially the urbanites, have no idea whatsoever of just how dependent they are on the electric supply. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And if it goes out for more than an hour or two, they're just totally bewildered, and they think they've been betrayed by the powers that be, that God himself has turned against them or whatever, but they do not understand just how dangerous these things are and how deadly they can be when extended through time.
Now, I did have a question for you before I went on my little speech there. These coronal ejections are rather short-lived, aren't they? I mean, they don't have a great duration.
No, I'd say 90% of them are fixed within a few hours, or let's say less than a day.
Yeah.
And some of them last a few days.
Something like that might be good for us, you know? I mean, people need to be aware. I don't wish harm on anybody, you know, and I don't wish misfortune or hardship on anybody either. But I used to work for Outward Bound and the National Outdoor Leadership School. These are, you know, it's kind of a boot camp thing a little bit, you know, that you put people through it. You're sleeping on the ground, not showering for a month. You know, all that kind of thing that is just to put you through an ordeal. Be close to nature, get in touch with what you really need to survive, and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And everybody needs a lot of that. Because our
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. I think a boot camp.
All right.
a boot camp for citizens.
Just get back to nature, Michael. And get in touch with the reality when you don't have this infrastructure.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. We're going to move on to the next questioner. That would be Wayne Costi. Wayne, you're up.
Yeah, thanks. I guess first, I'd like to add a couple of technical clarifications. As someone who's worked in the electric power industry for quite a long time, I believe that the main issue with microelectronics and things like that being destroyed are electromagnetic pulses, which are a nuclear weapons explosion type issue, not a coronal mass discharge. The coronal mass discharge issues are caused by large DC induced DC currents in the Earth that will do things like saturate transformers, and that is why the telegraph operators noticed them. So just to clarify those couple of issues there, but I do have a comment, a recommendation almost, I think, for the for Ken for Key. And that is to kind of basically merge a power outage and a flood. You might want to take a look at the analyses of what happened after Superstorm Sandy in the New York City, Long Island area. There you had exactly the situation in which you were talking about, in which people in lower Manhattan were devoid of electricity for weeks. As Con Ed tried to figure out how to fix the system that had been flooded as a result of Superstorm Sandy. I really think you should take a look at that. I don't know how many people died as a result of that. But
was that Tropical Storm Sandy?
Yes. They called it Superstorm. It hit New York City at kind of a high tide period and flooded lower Manhattan.
And what year was that?
I think that's probably 2013, 2012. It's not a huge. It would not have registered on your scale of largest electrical outages. But it is one of those instances that is very much worth.
That's a very good, might make a good benchmark.
Right, because it actually flooded lower Manhattan, and for weeks, it was literally weeks, people could not use the elevators in their apartment houses. They were had to abandon them. And I know people that have actually fled New York City because of it.
Yeah,
Because
of my current preoccupation, I drive around this city, London, Ontario, population close to 500,000, and I look at all those massive new apartment buildings going up and the massive ones that have been there for some time, and I just try to imagine how many people are living in them and what's going to happen to them if something like this happens. Now, nuclear events that you mentioned off the top there is another issue, of course. If there's some kind of nuclear war that goes on, who knows how that comes about. But that would, of course, render your electronics useless as well, because the pulse from a nuclear explosion is quite powerful, apparently. Maybe you know more about that than I do, though.
Well, I appreciate your bringing this topic to the teleconference, but I don't have anything else to add at this time, wish you well on your further research. Over.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your bringing your expertise to play in this matter. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. And our last person is Kat McQuire. Last person in the queue. Go ahead, Kat. Kat McGuire.
Yeah. Okay. Kat? Ken, is that? Kat?
Yeah, we're waiting for Kat to ask her a question or make her comment. Kat McGuire? Kat McGuire. Going once, going twice. Okay, Kat? Kat, I see you muting and unmuting here. I don't know what's going on with that. Okay. Okay, Kat, Camp McGuire.
There she is.
There you are.
I don't know how it got to me. It must have been a mistake, so I'm sorry. No, I don't have a question.
You don't have a question?
No, I didn't. I don't know what happened.
You didn't. Oh, okay. All right. Well, that was just.
I do, though, Ken. Ken, it's Craig. I have one.
Oh, okay. Well, then you go ahead, Craig, and we'll drop Ken off. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Now, this question might be a little off the wall, but one of my own preoccupations is Hollywood films and television and things and other sort of products like that and sort of what they have to say about the state of our world. And one of the things that I've noticed in the last few years in particular is there is an enormous proliferation of films and TV shows about the breakdown of society. And some of those are because of some kind of event that's sort of like what you're describing. There are ones that deal with zombies, which people think that's really science fiction.
I've noticed the same trend exactly, and I find it extremely interesting that there has been, as you say, quite a proliferation of these things, including, I think, the one they push the hardest is called Survivor. It's where one man who's sort of at the very end of the chain of consideration after you lose your president, who ends up being president of the United States, and he has to deal with some, I don't even know what the nature of the disaster is, because I never watched the movie, but apparently it's pretty awful. A lot of people are dying, and he has to make some executive decisions, and he ends up being some kind of hero, I guess. It looks like an ordinary person, not exactly Trump-like.
Well, there are also shows that really talk about the complete breakdown, not even without leaders, where it kind of made me think when you were describing earlier about what would happen in a power failure, that there would be gangs of people that would be going and looting and doing different things. Well, that's exactly what a lot of these shows deal with. You know, some of them deal with viruses that kill a bunch of people or most of the planet, and some deal with the appearance of zombies, and other ones there was a show called Revolution where all the electricity on the earth just went out instantly, and it was about what happened after, you know, 10 years later, what the society looked like. So what do you make of that? I mean, what do you make of all that?
What's the name of that last film?
It's a TV show. Yeah, it was
TV
called
show.
Revolution. Revolution.
Was it a series,
and
it was a series.
Yeah. No, it was a series. I think it might only have run two seasons.
It's
not running currently. Revolution.
Revolution. Right. Okay. Just a second. I want to make a note about that. Okay.
Yeah. I have extensive notes about all this stuff.
I'm back. I like to gather any information I can while I'm involved with the teleconference here, and I appreciate that kind of information. What do I make, you're asking, of what? Of those appearance of those movies? Do you think are we being prepared for something? Might be a natural question.
Yes. That was kind of my question, yeah.
Right. I don't know why we would be prepared for something if the aim was to get rid of most of us. they might not want too many people to survive. If they did, of course, many of us would have a plan ready, even if our municipal office didn't have a plan, or if our state government didn't have a plan, or a provincial government, or whatever. There might be people, you know, in the woodwork, in the deep state, if you want to call it that, who do have a plan, and they will broadcast going down street after street of your town, village, or city, saying, please come to the such and such square by tomorrow at noon to board buses for a camp where you will be protected and fed, and off you go to the FEMA camp.
Right.
Or the huge underground living quarters under the Detroit River, or whatever, people think is going on. I'm not an expert at, by any means at any of these. I believe the camps do exist. I don't know what they're for, but it's a little ominous, slightly ominous to me. That could be part of a plan that goes with a power failure. A good question, by the way, here also is, how do you induce a power failure? I'm kind of reluctant to discuss that because I could be accused of advocating terrorism by explaining how to take down a power station. At the moment, I haven't a clue how to take down a power station. There has been an example apparently of a hacker getting into the New York or New Jersey power grid. I forgot which one it is. Finding the command that shuts down a power station and implementing it, and the power station shut down. As a result of this incident, authorities have implemented a new strategy where the operator, the designated operator or person in authority, shuts it down with a voice command, which the hacker apparently can't duplicate. So it's not just a matter of passwords, because all passwords are stored somewhere, and a hacker can usually get to them. I did an article in Scientific American in 1984 called Core Wars. It's about computers fighting computers. And this is battles between two pieces of software. One's trying to infiltrate the other, and the other is trying to protect it from being infiltrated. And it's a kind of a crazy game because for every measure, there's a countermeasure. For every countermeasure, there's a counter-countermeasure. For every counter-countermeasure, there's a counter-counter-countermeasure. And it just goes on endlessly. And sometimes I'm afraid that's the structure of the plans that have been arraigned against us here. So the final result is I'm not even sure if we can trust Trump.
Okay, looks like we've got two more people that would like to ask questions. So I'd like to ask them both to be brief. And if you don't mind, Key, try to be concise with your response because we're coming
up
to
the top of our time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, so we got three now. Oh, and Barton Bruce has just joined the call, apparently. He's one of the people on this queue to ask a question. Okay,
we'll
so Michael Cook, yeah, you've already been on, I think, so you have to be very quick. What is your question? Michael?
Hey, thank you. I'll be very quick. I wouldn't make too much of the TV and the movies. It makes great fodder, you know, and this is, like I say, the situation's real obvious. A lot of people thinking are aware of the situation, so it's natural that it would make it in. I don't necessarily think we're being prepared for something. They're just, you know, making use of what's available for entertainment. I do know how to take down the power grid. I'm not going to tell you.
Uh-oh. You're on record now.
Regionally, not over the whole nation unless you had a really well-organized team. As far as we can trust Trump, I don't know. You know, he said he was going to look into 9/11. He said he was going to go after the Federal Reserve, and I'm just keeping my fingers crossed. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks. I don't think that one needs a response. And let's go to Bill Welch, who hasn't asked a question yet. Bill?
Hi. So it occurred to me about Mr. Dewdney's presentation that there might be a connection to 9/11 and the Office of Emergency Management that was in Building 7. That is to say, did these guys were they the guys in the Office of Emergency Management, had they put together any plans to deal with the kind of thing that happened on 9/11?
You know, that's a really good question, if I may answer now.
I'm wondering if
someone's going to ask it, if we can ask FEMA or send some kind of an official letter to them saying, what plans have you got for, you know, extended power failures, extended in time or in area, and what can you tell us about how we as individuals should be doing to get prepared? The answer might be very revealing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking because, you know, we know that there are the military exercises taking place, variously described as 8 to 43. I think Webster Tarpley calls it 43. But if these guys, one, if they didn't have plans, and they should have, it's gross negligence. If they had them very nicely in place, it may go to foreknowledge. But it's just sort of a whole, you know, one of those bureaucratic backgrounds that we haven't had any exploration of.
That's right. That this is fertile territory, I think, for future inquiries, or present inquiries, actually. And, I mean, I don't know the answer. I know that FEMA is often blamed for one thing or another. I know that FEMA is somehow involved with 9/11, not just because of their occupation of Building 7, but other related matters related to 9/11. But beyond that, I know very little about FEMA or their plans, or whether they do have any kind of remedial plan in place to take care of a national or state emergency of that scale.
Thank you. Let's go to Barton Bruce. Barton?
Hi, this is Barton. I get just several questions and some little comments. You see these SC switches on pole tops, which are basically from a local substation. This isn't a large region, but it may be several of them in a town, and they let the town or even like a hospital have multiple feeds coming around different directions. But if something big short circuits up at primary voltage there, it'll take out some part of the thing. But a lot of these things shut down and then back off, and then they've got this clever algorithm where they can jump back in and see if it's safe, or if they can do something safe to help the more people get
That's
connected.
Right.
But this microwave links from those that I assume could be sabotaged, and I certainly would hope those are well encrypted or whatever. But Wayne's in the business of dealing with this stuff, you know, in the power grid. And there's used to be these things about don't let your kiddies take aluminized Mylar balloons in big bundles near power lines, and if they accidentally let them go, that could be bad trouble. Is there anything that can be done to mediate against that?
Yeah. Oh, against what?
A large bunch of conductive balloons getting up in the way high tension grids.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
Especially if someone tried to do it on purpose.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Apparently there's been accidents where they've gotten up there and they make a short circuit path. I know when I used to work for a phone company, and we had training classes every year on how to go on Amtrak right-of-ways where you've got 10,000 volts up there on the wire above. And these kids take audio cartridges with, you know, the brown recording tape, and they wing them over it, and they hang down, and they say, be careful, if you get near one of those things, you know, you'll get electrocuted, because that conducts. And there's all these things that can happen that are, you know, strange and weird and all that. Of course, if an acceleration train's coming by 100 plus miles an hour, you don't want to be anywhere near it. You'll be sucked underneath it and ground up into the, well, anyway. But that's all the stuff they trained you about.
Drones be a problem? You know, someone runs
drones are a big
too.
Problem for everybody, and you see some of these films on YouTube, and there's guys supposedly in Russia, or they might be in the United States, they're pretending to be in Russia, so they won't know what you're doing, and they won't know they're domestic. And there's a machine gun mounted under a rather large drone, and it's remotely controlled, and it does some devastating thing to the dummies they have in front of it. And like, that technology is clearly readily available to lots of people, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You have another question, Bart, real quick?
Yeah, I had another one. For EMP protection, you see, here's some of these prepper type things. If you find them on YouTube, they say, take a regular portable radio with battery, turn it on, and then bury it in your big metal rubbish barrel with a metal lid that fits a snug-fitting metal lid, and see just how far the lid has to go on, and you can hear the sound coming through the, you know, from inside, and you'll be amazed that the lid's on pretty tight and the thing's still playing. And finally, when you snap the lid on the last little bit, it shuts the sound down. But the you know, radio waves are getting in there, and so EMP pulses, I guess, might too. How do you make a safe home thing you can put all your, you know, electronic stuff that you might want in there? And even the electronic circuitry in a LED flashlight, is that going to be trashed? And, you know, like,
well, you see, this is a good question. Now, the only tiny bit of expertise I have in that area relates to my cell phone investigations, when I was comparing the power emanating from a cell phone at 0.2 watts somewhere in the passenger cabin trying to reach the ground compared with the 30-watt aircraft antenna, which is right up in the forward belly of the aircraft, very close to the so-called delicate navigational instruments, quote-unquote. What does all that mean? Well, that's the reason why we're not supposed to use cell phones on aircraft. The 0.2-watt signal coming from the passenger section, you know, which is some distance away from the delicate navigational instruments, and the 30-watt antenna, which is right next to them. If that's not a problem, how can the cell phones be a problem? In other words, they may not have wanted people to use cell phones, so they'd never discover that they don't work, so that the story of 9/11 would work. You see what I mean?
Well,
anyway.
It may be because you have to acquire cell towers, and you're going to be seeing so many, and there's going to be a lot of confusion there. But I can remember being in planes years ago where the pilot was really sort of getting pissed because somebody had something on. And then I saw a guy, he was sort of going over the intercom, come on, you've got to shut it down. And then there's someone a few rows away from you, you could see him, he's busy shutting something off. And then the captain on the PA system says, thank you, and then we proceed. Clearly it was in sync. So he was aware of its interference.
Yeah, he must have had some equipment running on the same frequency, I guess. But the whole point of my remark, however, was to conclude by saying that those delicate navigational instruments are protected by a grounding device known as a Faraday cage, F-A-R-A-D-A-Y, cage, a Faraday cage named after the early English physicist.
We're really out of time on this segment. But Kat McGuire is on the queue, and I just have to check with her to make sure she didn't think of a question to ask. Kat, did you think of something you wanted to talk about?
This is
Kat.
This was me. This is Tim.
Yeah. Who?
Tim, I was just told that I can now ask my question.
Who? Tim.
Tim Michael.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Maybe my telephone number isn't registered.
It's coming up as Kat McGuire for some reason, but go ahead.
Okay. Wow. All right. I was just a couple of things. First thing, a Faraday cage you can build in your house. Just put a wire mesh, and no signal can travel through that Faraday cage. It's been shown many times. I believe it was. I can't remember, but somebody built.
That's the point I was trying to make. Yeah, you're right.
Right. But the other thing is, I took a class called Energy and Society. It was through our physics department. It was one of our kind of more general classes that we took in there. And one of the things that we were studying at the time was, the effects of what happens if fossil fuel runs out. And the thing is that one thing that we pointed out, you know, every light switch, everything that you do on a daily basis no longer works. It's not just you won't be able to drive your car, but you can't turn the lights on. You know, you can't turn the television. Well, that's not important. But they said even the water that we have, and especially in Southern California where I'm at, it has to be pumped over the mountains down into the LA Basin. If the pumps all stop, then we don't have any water either. So there's just a number of things that fail if we don't have that. And I was wondering if that is probably some of the hysteria that's going on in the energy sector about trying to do all of the, trying to get every last little bit of dirty oil, like the Athabasca tar sands and the shale oil.
Fracking,
and all of this other stuff, right? We know that the fracking solution is going into the water, and I think there's a calculation there that says, well, yeah, people will get sick, but at least they won't die.
Yes. Well, that might be.
Okay. That's all we have time for. Thank you so much for your presentation, Dee, and you're certainly welcome back anytime. If you'd like, we'd be glad to add you to our mailing list so you can be aware of what's upcoming and you know, welcome to join us at any time, whether you're presenting or not.
I like the announcements of the teleconferences. It's always good to see people involved in that.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll include you on the list. And thanks again for joining us. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Keep sending it, okay?
Sure, we'll do. Okay.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you. Now,
thanks, Key.
We're going to move on now to our announcements, and I'm going to put it into Q&A mode because it's important that we be able to get through this without interruptions here. So if you want to make an announcement, just press star 6, and you'll be in the queue to make them. And while we're waiting for people to do that, I will go ahead with announcements that I have scheduled. First of all, from the debate last week, those of you who joined us or tuned in later and listened to the debate, we said we would announce the results of the survey results of the debate on this call, and here they are. Two people voted in favor of Barbara making the stronger presentation that there was a plane destroyed at the Pentagon. 10 people voted in favor of Craig making the stronger case that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon. One person voted in favor of both of them making equally strong presentations, and one person voted in favor of both of them making ineffective presentations. So that is our summary, and again, that's not a scientific survey, but it hopefully does represent some relevant feedback. And I have a relevant announcement to make regarding that debate. I received a message yesterday, from Richard Gage, and he requested that I read this into the record regarding his position. He writes, and this is for the record, "I heard that on your last teleconference call and in a follow-up email, there was an indication by Barbara Honegger that I had endorsed her theory or theories about what happened at the Pentagon. Would you kindly clarify my position on this by mentioning on the call forwarding by email to your list the following statement from me? Quote, AE 9/11 Truth does not endorse any particular theories or any researchers regarding the destruction at the Pentagon on 9/11. And while I have been initially impressed by various presentations on this subject and offer quotes implying such, these quotes should in no way be construed as an endorsement of any presentations, theories, or researchers," end quote. On a personal note, I was informed that my name was also used in the same communication by Barbara as implying support for his theory. And as with Richard, I have in the past made statements supporting Barbara's larger research effort with regard to the Pentagon that I still stand behind today. However, I do think it is illicit to imply that this means support for any particular theory or conjectures on Barbara's part regarding explanations of elements of her research. So I wanted to say that for the record as well. Okay. Now, let's move on to others who may have announcements. Oops, is anybody on the queue here?
Ken, I think I pressed the star 6 to make an announcement, and it muted me. So I think we're in the mode where we're going to get muted if we do star 6.
Is that right?
That was my...
Let's try it again. Star 6, if you would like to make an announcement. Star 6. I'd like to get in the queue to make an announcement. Well, Cheryl, if you came in, okay, all right, there, it's working, Cheryl. Okay, so you may make your announcement. Go ahead.
Okay, so I just wanted to say in response that Barbara made the announcement earlier about the whole Trump thing with the election fraud,
mm-hmm.
and ABC has done an interview with him, and they're advertising it that this is the big issue they're asking about, and they're asking him to provide evidence. So it's going to be on this evening at 10 p.m. on ABC,
mm-hmm.
if anyone wants to watch that.
Okay, thank you. All right, and
Michael Cook, do you have an announcement?
Hey, thanks. Well, I guess I'd refer everybody to Hacking Democracy and Murder, Spies, and Voting Lies. If you're not aware, Karl Rove's head IT guy was subpoenaed during one of the elections, or just after, and his plane went down, and he couldn't testify. He was coming to testify on that flight. So there's a lot of dirt there, and even though it's Alex Jones, maybe we'll get some mileage out of this. We'll see. I have no plans to take down the electrical grid. Okay.
Okay. Well, that's a fair announcement after announcing that you were able to do it. So thank you. Okay. All right. And Bill Wilt.
Hi. On a slightly humorous note, in answer to Graham McQueen's telling us about nonviolent extremism, I would submit that perhaps the phrase wretched excessivism might be also useful. Wretched excessivism. That's it.
Okay. So apparently that's it for announcements. If nobody else has one, let me take it off of mute just in case anybody's having trouble getting on the thing here. We don't want anybody to... Okay, so does anybody else have an announcement that wasn't able to get on the queue?
Yes, but Ken, I've been trying to ask a question of Key for a very long time, and you forgot to
I apologize, Barbara, but we were way over time, but I do apologize.
I know you were over time, but you just got to remember.
Okay, you're right. I got to remember. I got to remember.
Those of us for whom the Star 6 does not work.
Okay. But I remember this time, so what is your announcement?
Well, I just want to congratulate Greg. And
thank you.
I'm sorry that there weren't more votes for what I believe is the stronger position, but of course that is my position. I would also like to make clear that there was no implication that Richard Gage has supported my theory. I simply referred to the list of actual responses, including Richard Gage's, that I sent to the list. Richard Gage's response is what it is, that my presentation of Smoke Curtain blew his mind. That's it. And I object to anyone thinking or implying that I implied that any particular quote there was anything more than its quote. So that's number one. Number two, just for the record, what I was trying to get through to Keith, that is number one, people need to know that the World Trade Center 7 Office of Emergency Management, OEM, was supposed to have been designed, this has been claimed, and I could find it and send it to everybody if you're interested, supposed to have been designed to withstand a nuclear attack in New York City. So if it was designed to withstand a nuclear attack, it had to have been presumably designed to withstand an EMP and a power outage. That's number one. Number two, at the Naval Postgraduate School, where I was a senior journalist for 16 years here in Monterey, California, there is an unclassified master's thesis that a single nuclear explosion in a plane at about 35,000 feet or anywhere up there will knock out the entire power grid in the United States that is not, that special underground fiber optic cable. And I happen to know from having been in the White House in 1981, starting January 20, 1981, in the Reagan administration, that they were already, the federal government was already putting fiber optic cable underground for all of its major so-called national security communications. So believe me, they already have that now. So I just wanted people to know that I was trying very desperately to get that information through to Keith. Thank you.
I apologize for not doing that, Barbara, but I think it would be useful for you to forward those comments on to Key. I think he'd be interested in that point.
I will do that. I just wish I didn't have to. Thank you.
I understand. I know. I apologize. Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. So, okay. I guess that's it for tonight's call. We'll see y'all at the last Wednesday in February. I think it's the 22nd. hopefully another interesting teleconference. So have a good month, everybody, and we'll see you then.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.
Everyone.
Bye. Good night.
Press home to open. Turn to call.
Ken?
Yeah, hey, Cheryl.
Yeah, hi.
Hey, hang on.
Okay.